25. To Apollon Nikolaevich Maikov, the well-known author, 1821-97. Semipalatinsk, January the 18th, 1856. I meant to answer your kind letter long ago, my dear Apollon Nikolaevich. As I read it, there came to me a breath of the past. I thank you 1,000 times for not having forgotten me. I don't know why, but I always had the feeling that you wouldn't forget me. Perhaps because I can't forget you. You write that much has altered in this interval, and that we've both been through many transformations. For myself, I can answer. I could tell you many interesting things about myself. But please don't be angry with me for writing now in all haste, so that my letter must be broken and even perhaps confused. I am feeling just what you felt as you wrote, the impossibility of expressing oneself fully after so many years, even though one should write 50 pages. One must have the word of mouth and the personal contact so that one can read the countenance and hear the heart speak in the tone. One word spoken frankly, two by two, face speaking to face, means more than dozens of sheets of writing. I thank you most particularly for all you told me about yourself. Here follow some remarks about people with whom Maikov was connected. Perhaps you have heard something of me from my brother. In my hours of leisure, I am putting down a good many notes of my prison memories, The House of the Dead, published 1861-62. There are but few personal details in these sketches, though. When I finish them, and if a really good opportunity offers, I'll send you a manuscript copy as a keepsake. Here follows a cordial recommendation of the bearer of this letter, Baron A. Wrangel. You write that you have thought of me warmly, and always asked yourself, to what end, to what end? And I too have thought warmly of you, but your question, to what end, I shall answer not at all, for whatever I might say must necessarily be waste of words. You write that you have done a great deal, thought a great deal, got a great deal that is new from life. It could not have been otherwise, and I'm sure that we should now agree in our views. For I too have thought a great deal and done a great deal. Such unusual circumstances and influences have combined in my experience that I have had to undergo, think, and weigh far too much, more than my strength was equal to. As you know me very well, you'll easily believe that in all things I was guided by those considerations which seemed to me to be just and upright, that I never played the hypocrite, and that when I took up any particular matter, I put my whole soul into it. Don't think, though, that I mean by these words to refer to the circumstances which have brought me here. I'm speaking now of more recent experiences. Nor would it be relevant to allude to those gone-by occurrences. They were nothing but an episode after all. One's views alter. One's heart remains the same. I have read your letter through, but failed to understand the most essential part of it. I mean about patriotism, the Russian idea, the sense of duty, national honour, and all those things of which you speak with such enthusiasm. But my friend, were you ever any different? For I was always inspired by those very emotions and convictions. Russia, duty, honor? Why, I always was Russian through and through, and I say it most decidedly. What then is new about the movement which is becoming perceptible around you, and of which you write as of a novel tendency? I tell you quite frankly that I don't understand you. I have read your poem and thought it exquisite. I wholly share your patriotic emotion, your efforts towards the moral emancipation of the Slavs. It is there that Russia's mission lies, our noble, mighty Russia, our Holy Mother. How beautiful are the concluding lines of your Council at Clermont. Whence do you draw the eloquence with which you have so magnificently expressed those powerful thoughts? Yes, indeed I do share your idea that in Russia Europe will find her final account. It is Russia's true mission. That was always clear to me. You write that our society seems to be awakened from its apathy. Yet you know that our society never does make manifestations. And who shall conclude therefrom that it is nerveless? Once an idea is really made clearly manifest, and society called upon to examine it, society has always grasped it at once. And so it is now. The idea has been grandly, most nationally and chivalrously, one must declare that, made manifest. And behold, that very political ideal which Peter the Great fashioned for us has at once been universally accepted. Perhaps you were and are offended by the fact that in those strata of society where people consciously think, feel, and investigate, French ideas are gaining ground? Undoubtedly, there is a tinge of exclusiveness in that. Still, it is in the nature of all exclusiveness instantly to produce its own antithesis. You will admit yourself that all reasonable thinking men, and that means those who set the tone in everything, have ever regarded French ideas from a purely scientific standpoint, and that even they who most leaned towards exclusiveness remained unchangingly Russian throughout. What do you see new in that? I assure you that I, for example, feel so near to all Russians that even the convicts never alarmed me. They were Russian. They were my brothers in misfortune, and I often had the joy of discovering magnanimity in the soul of a robber and murderer. But it was only because I am Russian myself that I could thus understand him. I have to thank my ill luck for many practical experiences, which probably have had a great influence upon me. But I learned at the same time that in my very inmost being, I have always been Russian. One may be mistaken in an idea, but one can't mistake one's heart and lose one's conscience by reason of the mental error, by which I mean one can't act against one's convictions. But why am I writing all this to you? I know well that these lines don't in the least express what I mean. Then why do I go on writing? I'll tell you instead some things about myself. In prison, I read only very little, for I couldn't get any of the books I wanted, though often books of a sort came into my hands. Since I've been here in Semipalatinsk, I've read rather more, but still I have no books, not even necessary ones at hand, and time is going by. I couldn't at all tell you how very much I suffered from not being allowed to write in prison. My mental labour comes only thus to the boil. Some things were all right. I felt it. I planned out in that way a great novel, which I consider will be my definitive work. I was dreadfully afraid that the first passion for my work would have gone cold when the years had passed, and the hour of realization struck at last, that passion without which one cannot write. But I was mistaken. The figure which I had conceived, and which is the basis of the whole book, needed some years for its development, and I am convinced that I should have ruined all if I had then, unready as I was, begun the work in the first flush of zeal. But even when I left the prison, I did not set to, though all was quite ready in my mind. I simply could not write. A circumstance, a contingency, which long had delayed to enter my life, and then at last did invade it, wholly carried me away, intoxicated me. I was happy. I could not work. Later, I was to know grief and sadness. I lost something which was my all. Hundreds of versts now divide us. The reference is to Madame Isaev, later Dostoevsky's wife. I won't speak more precisely, but will perhaps explain all at some other time. Now I cannot. However, I have not been wholly idle. I have done some work, but the carrying out of my chef d'oeuvre I have postponed. For that I need to be in a more tranquil mood. I began for fun to write a comedy. I invented so many droll characters and episodes, and liked my hero so much that I abandoned the form of comedy, although I quite enjoyed it, solely that I might prolong as far as possible the pursuit of this new hero's experience and my own laughter at him. He is like myself in many respects. In a word, I am writing a comic novel, Uncle's Dream. Hitherto I have been describing only separate adventures, but now I've had enough of that, and am unifying the whole. There's my full report of work. I can't help writing it all to you. When I talk with you, my unforgettable friend, I keep thinking of our past. Indeed, I was so often happy in your company. How could I forget you? You write of literature. For a year I've hardly read anything. I'll give you my impressions, such as they are. Turgenev pleases me best. It is only a pity that he's so often unequal to his great talent. Tolstoy I like very well, but I have an idea that he won't do much. Perhaps I'm mistaken, however. Ostrovsky I don't know at all. I've read nothing of his, though I've seen many extracts from his works in the articles about him. He may know a certain section of Russian society very accurately, but I don't believe he's an artist. Moreover, he seems to me a writer utterly without ideals. Please try to persuade me to the contrary. For goodness sake, send me those works of his which you consider the best, that I may not be acquainted only with the criticisms of him. Of Pisemsky I know only The Swaggerer and The Rich Suitor, nothing else. I like him very much. He is sane, good-humoured, and even naive. He can tell a story like a master. One thing is a pity. He writes too fast. He writes much too fast and much too much. A man should have more ambition, more respect for his talent and his craft, and more love for art. When one's young, ideas come crowding incredibly into one's head. But one should not capture each and all of them as it flies and rush to give it forth. One should rather await the synthesis and think more. Wait till the many single details which make up an idea have gathered themselves into a nucleus, into a large, imposing picture. Then, and not till then, should one write them down. The colossal figures created by the colossal writers have often grown out of long, stubborn labour. But the attempts and sketches that go to the picture should not be displayed at all. I don't know if you'll understand me. But as far as Pisemsky goes, I think that he doesn't hold his pen sufficiently in check. Our literary ladies write like other literary ladies, that is, cleverly, neatly, and with much fluency of expression. Tell me, please, why a woman writer is almost never a serious artist. Even the undoubtedly colossal artist George Sand often spoilt herself by her purely feminine traits. During the whole time there, I came across many of your short poems in the newspapers. I liked them greatly. Be strong and labour. I'll tell you in confidence, in strict confidence. Tyutchev, Fyodor Tyutchev, 1803-73, the most profound of Russian poet-philosophers, is very remarkable, but etc. What Tyutchev is it, by the by? Is it our one? Many of his poems are excellent. Farewell, my dear friend. Excuse the incoherence of this letter. One can never say anything properly in a letter. On that account alone, I can't bear Madame de Sévigné. She wrote much too good letters. Who knows? Perhaps I shall some day clasp you in my arms again. May God so appoint it. For God's sake, show my letter to nobody, really nobody. I embrace you.